cut out and just let
I'm going to get you to do it.
Okay, thanks for showing up this morning. Today I'm going to be talking about, I'm Kyle Marta. Today I'm going to be talking about Magma Energy. It's a small cap, pure play geothermal. It's located in Vancouver, but it actually has projects in operation in Nevada and Iceland, and projects as well in different stages of development all over the United States and South America. The reason why I think it would be a good pick is because I don't think the earnings potential or fully reflected in the current stock price, and I think a catalyst going forward next year would be that full operations in its Salt Lake project in Nevada go online, and so we'll start making revenues. And I think as far as geothermal energy is concerned, it's the stars are really aligning as far as renewables. Geothermal is actually quite simple. Underground, you have these natural nuclear reactions that are occurring. And if it's close to the surface, you have heat that's created, and you also need a permeable surface as well as some liquids below the ground. And what's good about geothermal also is as expandable assets. Once you set up a plant in one area, then if there's geothermal deposits close to this area, which is highly likely, then you can use the same plant and equipment to expand your asset base. Another important part is that it uses the you can use the waste heat, which is another technology that's being developed right now, to expand production using the same facilities. So as far as competitive advantage, the most obvious one being that it's very clean, as with many renewables. The most important one, however, is that it's reliable. If you look at the capacity factors, which is the actual output relative to the potential output, it's always consistently over 90%, and that's more than you can say for wind energy and sun energy, which varies a lot with conditions, with the environmental conditions. And this is important because if you look at, for example, Nevada, where it has its operations, it's pumping the energy into the grid, and retail utility companies are required by law to have a certain percentage of their retail output taken from renewables, and so they need a good power source that has a consistent base load, and that's what geothermal energy is good for. As far as costs, as the lowest all-in costs of the renewable energies, it has very high upfront costs. But again, the lifetime of these projects can be over 100 years. There's been geothermal plants that have actually been in existence over 100 years. So it is long-lived. And as far as technological risk is concerned, it's also low risk. Its inputs, it actually powers itself. It uses its own energy. And so the cash flows are actually very predictable as far as costs are concerned. I think the biggest competitive advantage is its management. Ross Beaty has been around for a long time, over 40 years of experience, or close to 40 years of experience. He's a geologist. He was a part of Pan American Silver before, which is one of the world's largest silver producers. He has a track record of bringing close to a dozen of companies from small commodity companies through development and selling them at high profit. And usually they're purchased by larger commodity companies. And he has a huge stake in the outcome. He has a 48% equity stake in this company right now. As far as its financial position, recently, this actually just happened over the past 2 weeks, they bought a company called HS Orca in Iceland, which is in operation right now. It was pretty controversial at the time. It took a few months to go through because it's actually pretty incredible the deal they got on it. Reykjavik Energy sold them the HS Orca plant, and they also provided the financing. They pay a 1.5% interest rate on the debt, and it's bullet debt, so it doesn't actually pay any cash flows until for the next 7 years when it pays the debt in full. And the only thing it had to use to back up as far as collateral for this loan was its own shares. So there's a bit of controversy actually in Iceland over this deal. And so it used $60 million in debt and $30 million from its balance sheet to finance this acquisition. So it still has another $30 million available in cash on its balance sheet for further acquisitions. But it may need to raise more capital as part of its strategy is going after the fragmented geothermal asset industry and buying these assets as they become available at cheaper prices in the tight credit markets. So an important part of if you want to start looking at valuation is the capacity of the plants and when they begin to come online. So as you can see, Soda Lake just came online this year, and by the end of 2011 or end of 2010, it will be on full. It will be producing its full output. What's important is this. You'll see there's a bit of a difference between these numbers and the next numbers because this excludes the HS Orca acquisition. So as you can see, by 2012, they were expected to have 55 megawatts of capacity. Now with the HS Orca purchase, you can see MXY to the right there. They have they're expected to have about 100 megawatts of capacity. Another important point, if you look at this graph, MXY relative to ORTMA, which is ORA right beside it. ORTMA is its largest competitor. It's a large market cap. It's located in Australia. It has huge operations, the largest operations as far as geothermal is concerned. But I think the difference here is that MXY has a much larger and much better portfolio. It's just that it's in a different stage of development. It's in the earlier stage of exploration and development. So that's what the stock price, the higher stock price represents is the speculative value in these properties. So one way to evaluate the company is you can look at, since it doesn't have, right now is negative net income and low earnings, so one way to look at it is you could take each project individually, you could weight it by its risk or its probability that the assets will be exploited. You could aggregate these numbers and then you could come up with the price per share. So if you look at the risk-adjusted price, it's just under $3, which the current share price is actually $193 right now. And if you look at the unrisked, which is just assuming 100% exploitation of all the assets, which is obviously unlikely, but just for the sake of interest, it's about $6 per share. And then if you want to look at comparables, here again, Ormat Technologies, largest market cap in geothermal at $1.7 billion, magma at the bottom there. What's important here is you can't look at PE because, again, its earnings, earnings are still unpredictable. Unless you look 3 or 4 years out, they're not going to have a positive net income. So what you do in geothermal, you can look at the enterprise value over the capacity, which is measured in megawatts. And magma energy is slightly above average as far as valuation is concerned, 4.2 million per megawatt. And a lot of people were saying that perhaps the shares were oversubscribed when the IPO happened over the summer. And this is probably because Ross Beaty has obviously a very important reputation, and he's been around for a long time, so that's probably why you have a bit of a higher price than similar companies. And finally, as far as risks are concerned, obviously it's very speculative. You have a lot of early stage projects right now in South America and the United States that a lot of them, as you saw before, won't be in line until 2015. And you have falling commodity prices. It's obviously correlated with oil. If you have lower oil prices, then renewables generally become more attractive. Another thing is financing the expansion, is if they want to continue to purchase other assets, or if they want to continue to grow, then they might have to raise more equity over the next year. And finally, as far as infrastructure, you need to have the power lines, or you need to have access from these geothermal plants to urban centers and to the grid. So there has to be the infrastructure in place, which might be key in South America. And that's it. Questions?
However, it's the first time I see a company less than half a billion in over 40 million shares. So, I mean, the fact that he owns 48% of the interest in the company, does this mean that he's got lots and lots of options, or he bought the business in the
It's a new company. It just had its IPO over the summer. And so they raised about $90 million in the IPO, which they've been using towards acquisitions. And so he doesn't actually have options in the company, because if you look at the diluted options, it's not much different. So I'm not really sure how to answer that, actually. I'm not too sure how he acquired his stake, but... Yeah. They did have some seed financing as well before they actually went public. So there's other partners that have a stake in the company as well from previous financing. So when they actually had their IPO, they had their portfolio already set up. So.
Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lincoln. Today I'm going to introduce China Medical, Sky One Medical. It's a pharmaceutical company. Yes. Sorry. It's a pharmaceutical company that. Okay. Thank you, Ken. It's a pharmaceutical company that produce mainly the traditional Chinese medicine for external use. So, the company was founded in 1994 and was listed in the Nasdaq last year. Its price currently was about $13 with a 6.4 times PE ratio. And its beta is 1.2, and diluted earnings per share is $2.07. It's a small cap company with about 220 million market cap. It has zero debt and did not pay any dividend. This is the stock performance in the past 2.5 years. The company has about 89 existing products on sale, and about the main issue was external use of traditional Chinese medicine, and the revenue breakdown can be broken down into six categories, including patch and ointment, spray, and diagnostic kits. Since 2005, the company has been experienced dramatically growth. Its revenue has grown from 7.5 million to 92 million last year. And net income increased from 2.2 million to 29 million as well. So the compounded average growth rate was kind of stunning. It's about 130% in the past 3 years. In the first two quarters this year, we can still see a highly rapid growth in both revenue and net income if we compare quarter by quarter. This table, we can see from this table that company has a very strong product pipeline. It has in this 89 product on sale, there's about 26 just get the SFDA approval recently. SFDA means State Food and Drug Administration. It's similar as the FDA. And there's about 12 product is under are pending for the final approval, and also there are 15 to 20 product are in the clinical trial, and more than 20 product is under research. And we can see the company put a lot of effort in the diagnostic kit and also the patch, this key product. And here, and more importantly, I would like to point out here is that company, in longer term, the company is going to put a lot of effort on the anti-cancer drugs, the endothelin one. The first one is the anti-cancer drug. It's a top category in a new medicine in China. And also the company invests a lot of money in a cancer early examination kit. This is a huge market with about 500 million market size in the coming future. So also the company has the exclusive right on the stem cell research in the northeast of China. China has only a few company has this kind of research right on this stem cell research in China. So also we can from this table we can see the company has its strategy to expand its product spectrum from traditional Chinese medicine to biomedical field, which has a large profit margin and also the market size. So this strategy also is one of its competitive advantage. And the other advantages include the broad product portfolio, which has lower risk on the individual product, and also its focus on R&D activity. Its R&D expense is about 7% of its revenue now, and management is going to increase to about 10% in a few years. And the company is very aggressive and expansion, and also they bought a lot of the company in last year, so it's a very aggressive company. The growth opportunity of this company include the 1.5 billion Chinese government investment in healthcare sector in the next 3 years, and here 1.2 $125 billion is not the total government health expense, but the increased amount. So the government tried to build a basic medical insurance system and covering more than 90% of the rural areas in the next 3 years, and also increase the government subsidies. The government also support the TCM, the product, and the biomedical industry as well. This government support the company to modernize the traditional Chinese medicine, and also it supports biomedical engineering project, such as the oncological and cardiology diagnostic product. The company has this kind of the examination kit, so it's gaining the support from the government. So also government support the company to develop its local the biotechnology capacity. We can see from the previous slides that the company has exclusive research right on the stem cell research. So all this, we can see the company is very well positioned to benefit from this trend, and because its product and its long-term strategy are kind of match quite well with the government's policy. The other growth opportunity is the market potential. Right now, the company has only less than 20% of the market share in the retail pharmacy and less than 5% in the hospital, the market share of the hospital. So we can see there's still quite a lot of room for the company growth. And the market size of its product is in China is very large. So and you can see from the graph, the province, the area which has the pink means it has its market share. The others has it's a blank market for him, for it. So the risk, the first one is pretty obvious because it's not assurance that the FSDA gonna approve its application in timely manner. The second one is the company's internal control. And not long ago, the company hired 26 years young graduate student as director, and named it as a member of the board. So after the investor find out, and the company replaced him with McKinsey consultant. So this is definitely one risk we should with concern. So compared to its peer, this company has a pretty low the P/E ratio, about 6.7, average is about 11, and it's very high growth, about 35%, and average is only 6.1%, and also the ROE and ROA is definitely outperform the peer. So I did a quick, relative analysis on this valuation. So based on a very conservative assumption on its revenue growth as well as the income and net income growth, the target price of the 2009, in the end of 2009, is $16.5. And in the next year, it's about $18 to $23. So it looks like it's undervalued. And are we going to buy it? It depends. If I just buy the few hundred stock, yes, I may. But if I hold millions of dollars and want to invest in this company, I would like to meet with the management team also to check if their strategy or their selling strategy, research and development strategy, is as same as they said in the annual report. So management is the key. So So that's my recommendation. Thank you. Any question? No, it's over-counter product. So, yeah, it's a well-branded product, and it's very competitive market as well. Yeah, and but if we have a close look at this revenue growth by product, we can see that the company grows a lot on these three products, and these three is they have a kind of exclusive. Now they have very strong competitive in the China. And they, for example, the patch and the diagnostic kit, these two, they are kind of leader in the Chinese market. So I believe it has its competitive advantage on this revenue growth.
Does it trade in New York as an ADR?
It's in NASDAQ.
NASDAQ?
Yeah, NASDAQ.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Wen-Ting Jiang. I'm an equity analyst covering utility sector. So today I will present to you Pacific Gas and Energy Corporation. I may refer it as PG&E during my presentation. So first I will talk about company's overview and then give you some key statistics about the company, following by strengths, opportunities, and weaknesses and concerns. And in the end, I'll give you a conclusion. Well, Pacific Gas and Energy Corporation, through a subsidy, operates as a public utility company that engages in electricity and natural gas distribution, primarily in Northern and Central California. And the company's key services include electricity and natural gas distribution, electricity generation, procurement and transmission, and natural gas procurement, transportation, and storage. So the table on the right just give you a general idea what's the stock price and how is the company structure and market cap of the company. And the table on the left shows you how the company performed relative to its peers. So there are two things I want to talk about. First is company's P/E ratio. The company's P/E ratio right now is 13.69, whereas the industry average is 12.22. So the company's P/E ratio is currently slightly higher than the industry average. And the company has a higher ROE ratio compared to the to its peers. The company's current ROE ratio is 15.39%, while the industry average is about 12.69%. So the company's one-year total return is 9.71%, which is much higher than the industry average, which is a negative 6.47. And the company does not only have a higher return, but also has a lower risk relative to the market. Company's adjusted beta is 0.62, whereas the industry average is 0.75. Last thing I want to talk about is employees' one-year growth rate for the company is 8%, which is four times more than the industry average. So those key statistics clearly give us a very positive sign to the company. And now we'll talk about the more fundamental things, the company's strengths and opportunities. Pacific Gas and Energy Corporation has a steady financial performance in recent years. Its revenue has grown from almost $12,000 million in 2005 to almost $15,000 million in 2008. And the steady financial performance provides a competitive edge to the company. The company also has a balanced generation mix. The company meets its electricity requirements through three ways: hydropower, nuclear power, and fossil fuel fires. The company, therefore, is not only over rely upon any one resource, so it may reduce the company's overall risk. The company has a diversified customer base, so 70% of its revenue is generated from electricity segments, and 30% is generated from natural gas segments. And out of the revenue generated from electricity segments, commercial consumers accounted for 39%, residential consumer accounted for 36%, industrial consumer accounted for 18%, and agriculture and other consumer accounted for 7%. And there are also like three different kinds of customers in natural gas segments, and they generate 62%, 26%, and 12% respectively. So with the growing environmental concerns and the rising energy price, customers and the governments are shifting their focus towards unconventional resources for energy. And Pacific Gas and Energy Corporation has a long history of purchasing, generating, and developing renewable energy. Since 2002, One California first set its long-term goal for increasing renewable energy deliveries. The company has signed over 1,000 megawatts of power that is generated from biomass, geothermal, solar, wind, and biogas resources. The company is also aggressively pursuing most promising next-generation renewable energy technologies. So a strong focus on renewable energy enabled the company to decrease the environmental obligations and also increase its revenue in the sector. The demand for electricity and natural gas has been increasing rapidly in North America. The total electricity sales projected to increase 1.9% annually from 2003 to 2025, and the total natural gas consumption projected to increase from 22 trillion cubic feet in 2005 to 26 trillion in 2030. So one of the weaknesses of the company is it generates almost all its revenue in California, while the competitors have been expanding their operations across diverse geographic areas. The company has all its operations in the U.S. and mostly concentrated in Northern and Central California. And the overdependence on a particular market exposes the company to many risks. And historically, energy utility operates as a regulated monopoly within the service territory, where they were essentially the sole suppliers of electricity and natural gas service. The services are priced on a bundle base, which means the company charged the energy they deliver with the service altogether. However, in recent years, companies has faced pressure to unbundle all those services, which are no longer considered as a natural monopolist. So this would increase the competition for the company in the future. Even though there's increased competition in the industry and the overdependence on the California may be a concern for the company, but the good ratios and key statistics clearly shows us the company has performed very well in past years, and steady financial performance also a very good attractive sign. Diversified customer base and balanced generation mix reduce the company's total risk, and also cost of effective renewable energy attracts a lot of environmental concerned customers and also reduce the company's operating costs. So I believe there's a lot of opportunity in the company, and my suggestion is to long the company's shares for the long run. Thank you. Any questions? No? Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for showing up. I believe I'm the last speaker of today and as well as the week, so I want to thank you guys for coming, Alex and Jen, for organizing all this. So I'm going to present to you Disney, and I'm focused on this company because they just or are in the process of acquiring Marvel, and I believe it's a really big step for them, and it's also really a boost for the whole company in general. So just some information. Right now, the stock's trading, well, yesterday at closing was $27.36. The year high was $34. And they have good return on assets, good return on equity, and a beta above 1, which is interesting as we believe that the economy will keep on growing in the future. So supposedly, the stock should grow more than the company. What I like about it is that it's the largest player in this category. No real competitor except maybe Time Warner. It has a huge growth opportunity that we'll discuss a bit later. And as I said earlier also, they just bought Marvel, which we can also relate to the Pixar acquisition 3 years ago. And there's a lot of synergies that go in there. And it's a very, very powerful brand name and a good company to be into. I'm pretty sure Steve Jobs and Fidelity won't disagree with me as they're the two main shareholders of this company. Here I wanted to focus on some key things. The decrease in the since 2008 to 2009 in the studio entertainment here has decreased, as well as parks and recreation and interactive media. Why do I point this out? Parks and resorts, I believe, with the economy picking up again and people having more money to spend, will probably spend more time on vacation and spend more money on vacation. So more money, more revenues, more net income for Disney. And interactive media, we'll discuss a bit later to explain what I think about it. Regional revenues, this is part of the growth opportunities. We see that they're 75% in North America, so they have a huge untapped market in Asia and Latin America. As a group, we all think that Latin America has a great potential, and as well as does Asia. So we really believe that there's a lot of growth to be seen forecasted in those regions, and that will just bring a lot more value to Disney as a whole company. This is a 5-year stock of Disney compared to the S&P 500. Why did I put the 5-year? Well, surely this is what is interesting here. They bought Pixar in January 2006. We saw that on the medium term, the stock went down a bit, and that's usually what happens when there's a big acquisition. Well, we might see that in the near future, the acquisition of Marvel as a negative sign, but I actually believe that this long run, that the sustainable growth that Disney had after buying Pixar with all the synergies, I really think that's what's going to happen with Marvel. Maybe not at the same extent because Marvel is a smaller company, but it still will boost the company as a whole. We see here that in 2006, between 2005 and 2006, the net income of Disney grew by a lot, with the revenue not growing as much as the net income. This is, really believe, a key thing about synergies, great management. In the 90s, Disney was not so powerful as it is now, and not so well run. They were selling a lot of assets in Florida, for example, and now they're creating a bigger empire than it ever was before, whether it's consumer product distribution channels, where they will be able now to put all the Marvel products, as well expanding in the media with new channels. For example, Disney XD is a channel for boys now, in which they'll be able to put all the Marvel shows, comic shows. And Disney is not very powerful in the whole gaming industry, and I believe that there's a lot to do with that, especially with all the Marvel characters coming into play. You can see that they just named Vice President of Creative at Disney Interactive Studio Alexander Seropian, who is the White Load CEO. White Load is a new company that Disney just bought. And Alexander Seropian is the person who created Bungie. Bungie is the main producer, the company that produced Halo. So he has really great experience in the gaming industry, and I really believe that this will be a great value added to the interactive to the gaming industry, gaming part, interactive media of Disney. On top of that, we talked earlier about theme parks and cruise revenue that will supposedly increase, as well as the Asia and Latin America that have a huge potential. So just want to point that out again. One risk is media. The media is one of the biggest revenue in as the division, and with all the internet getting tapped the whole market of TV shows as well as sports shows now that are watched on the internet. Disney also owns ESPN. There's a lot of intangibles about the publicity revenues, but I think that they're addressing this problem in a very good way, as they bought 25% of Hulu, who is one of the main distributors of TV shows online. And finally, one of my concerns also is the film unit chairman Dick Cook, who just resigned. He was working at Disney for the past 20 years. Is that a good thing? Because the film unit has been decreasing lately. We will see. Don Laster is somebody that might take over the film unit. He's the CEO of Pixar. So this is really something that we have to keep track of and see how that will affect the whole company and the income of this division of Disney. Well, thank you. And do you have any questions? I don't know how they want to expand there, but I know that it's a great place to be, and there's a lot of growth to be seen over there. Thank you very much. It's kind of unsure because there's a lot of issues with the whole rights about the characters and how do they develop the movies. For example, Hulk is owned by another company, the rights to Hulk, and they have the rights to keep the character only if they start using them in film production. So now we're hearing a lot about Hulk movies coming out in 2010, and Daredevil were huge flops at the box office. But still, those characters are just being thrown into production now because they want to sustain those rights and not let Disney take over the character for the production. So that's one of the main issues right now before they actually close the deal.
I see. There's still
financial.
$4 billion.
$4 billion. Yeah. Pixar was $7 billion, yeah. And it's a cash and stock transaction.
How do you compare the theme park unit with Six Flags
in terms of
size?
And
it's a tough question, but is it possible
Disney
could acquire Six Flags, or it's too big for them?
To tell you the truth, I'm not very aware about Six Flags company. January 2006.
And so do you see a very hugely profitable company? Do you ever see Disney spinning that unit off at some point in the future?
No, absolutely not. They're really creating great synergies with it and the whole film industry, and it's been very good for Disney as well as Pixar. They're really building an empire. There are talks about buying IMAX, about buying DreamWorks. So no, absolutely not. I don't believe so.
Yeah,
Well, DreamWorks is now people are thinking that DreamWorks might go to Time Warner for competition and all that. So, but they actually hold the rights to the distribution rights of all the DreamWorks movies starting now.
It's time to understand. You said Steve Jobs is one of the major shareholders of Disney.
Yeah, well, he was a major shareholder of Pixar at the time. So when they did the, it was.
Do you know what he owns now?
130 million shares. So times. Yeah, he's the largest. Yeah, and right after it's Fidelity. Fidelity. Steve Jobs number one. Fidelity is number two. Yeah.
This is Cal's thing.
Okay.
Because he's